This is WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you for dialing us in. Well, of the things we've been talking about on our show have segued a little bit into the Wintrust Business Lunch. 708 texted in and said roofers, drywallers, and landscapers for sure. They will be deported. Those industries will suffer. John, you forgot hotel service workers and the people who wash the dishes in the back of the restaurant. About the threats Tom Homan represented when he came to Chicago yesterday and told a GOP holiday party that they're going to target these people. They know where they are. They're going to find them. They're going to get them out of here. About all of that, Monica Ng and Axios talked to Illinois Restaurant Association Executive Director Sam Sanchez, who said, without the undocumented labor force, restaurants will shut down. While we deeply sympathize, said the Republican Cook County Commissioner Sean Morrison, with the plight of those seeking a better life here, compassion must be balanced with practical governance. It is imperative that we develop and implement a plan to address and work toward the immediate repatriation of migrants to their nations of origin. Sanchez, though, says many restaurateurs did not know how much of their staff was undocumented until COVID-19. Sanchez said everyone eligible for unemployment was getting $1,000 a week and traveling, but the undocumented people showed up and they kept our businesses going. They've been living, working, and paying taxes for 10, 20, 30 years, and now they're being targeted for deportation. It will hurt this industry tremendously. But deportation proponents argue that restaurateurs could hire documented people for the same jobs at higher wages. Sanchez says that's going to raise the price of the food a lot. The loss of millions of cooks, agricultural workers, meat processors, and servers across the country would rob the treasury of billions of dollars. Axios goes on to illuminate that point. I just wanted to also mention this does sound a little bit like the conversation we had yesterday with Elise Glink from Think Glink, the media expert and real estate watcher there. She, remember, yesterday pointed out that on a national basis, 52% of drywall installers, 48% of painters, 33% of carpenters on residential construction sites are foreign-born. In, for instance, the Lone Star State, immigrants make up about 40% of the construction workforce. According to the Census Bureau, immigrants account for 30% of all workers in the construction trades. We all know that it's much higher in the, as one of our listeners pointed out, the hotel industry, and Lord knows it's higher than that in the food and agriculture and meat processing businesses. These statistics don't tell us which percentage of these migrant workers are undocumented. I won't blame you if you suspect it's a lot. Don't know exactly what the numbers are, and I'm not sure how they'll figure that out when they come rolling in. Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at Bankrate.com. Ted, how much should I tip during the holidays?
Well, the median for the services that we asked about was generally between $20 and $50. We're talking about things like the mail carrier, the trash and recycling collector. They were on the low end, $20 for the median. And then it goes up. Teachers were $25, landscapers, gardeners, snow removers, $30. Child care providers and housekeepers were $50. Now, of course, not everybody is tipping. It was generally between about a quarter and about a half of people who have each of these services. Holiday tipping is a nice thing to do if you can afford it. And we actually found the trend is on the uptick this year, perhaps a suggestion that people are feeling a bit better about inflation and the state of the economy.
Oh, that's interesting. So as goes the tip, so goes the economy, or vice versa. People's personal economy is doing well. You know, maybe they're nice people, maybe they're not. But one way to sort of gauge the economy is, are they tipping more, right?
That's definitely a read that we have on this data. Yeah, we've been doing this every year since 2021. And in the 4 years we've done it, there have been some interesting patterns that have emerged. One is that 2022 was really the dip. Now, that was the year that inflation peaked. So the theory is that inflation really cut into purchasing power that year more than any other. And that was a year in particular where we saw the amounts go down. The frequency was still relatively high, but people were not tipping in as large amounts. And, you know, what we've seen now is the amounts have recovered. They're basically back to where they were in 2021. So they haven't stepped up because of inflation, but they haven't gone down either. Throughout the rest of the year, we've actually seen tipping behavior erode, and people are annoyed about tipping. You know, throughout the year, people express that tipping is just kind of a weird concept. A third say it's out of control. A third say they don't like those pre-entered tip screens you see at coffee shops and elsewhere. 6 in 10 have a negative view of tipping. Now, that's throughout most of the year. The holidays actually bring more generosity. It's that old-fashioned holiday spirit. But throughout a lot of the year, we're seeing people tip less at places like restaurants and hair salons and for taxis and ride shares. In that context, holiday tipping has been more stable.
Yeah, it's interesting when they flip the screen around and you think, wait a minute, I stood in line, I got the item, I'm paying for it, why do I have to give you a buck or 15% or whatever the suggested tip is? The owner of those businesses, they know how we feel about that. Is the trade, though, that while that may not be good for business in that sense, they'd rather suffer the ire of their customers than pay their employees more, because they could turn that feature off, right?
That's right. And as much as people grumble about it, they definitely tip. I mean, like Starbucks, yeah, for example, says that half of its credit and debit card customers leave a tip. And they unveiled credit and debit card tipping a couple of years ago. That 50% who tip has to be way higher than the percentage before that who were putting bills or coins in the old-fashioned tip jar. So it does work. People complain about it. And you're right, it's kind of a way to raise wages without raising prices, that you're basically pushing the customer to make up more of the difference and pay more of the employee's wages directly. This does rub a lot of people the wrong way. They complain about it at coffee shops and food trucks and quick service restaurants, but they often do still tip. Now, one thing that sets holiday tipping apart is not just the holiday spirit, but also the fact that we know these people and we interact with them regularly. One of the things that really ticks us off about, you know, counter service tipping is that it's very transactional. It's kind of this nameless, faceless kind of thing. Contrast that with holiday tipping, where maybe you have a weekly housekeeper or a regular nanny or babysitter, or maybe we're talking about your kid's teacher or daycare provider. I mean, someone that you're interacting with regularly, sometimes on a very personal basis, sometimes in your own home with your kids. That's one of the reasons why I believe people are tipping better around the holidays. It's more of a show of appreciation for people that we actually have a lasting relationship with.
Maybe we shouldn't call it tipping. Maybe it would better distinguish from the ire we have about tipping at restaurants or other places. Maybe it'd be better distinguish that from the people that provide these services. And I want to give you, it's a Christmas gift is what it is.
Good point. Yeah, that's definitely how teachers view it. You know, my wife used to be a teacher, and she would not view that as a tip, but definitely appreciated holiday gifts. And I feel like now it's gone from the individual gift, you know, maybe a kid would bring in an ornament or something or a mug, you know, that's how they used to do it. Now it's more the class parent asks everybody to Venmo them 10 or 20 bucks and then they buy a gift card for the teacher. I mean, that's often how it goes. And that is nice and it's appreciated. And it also takes some of the awkwardness out of it because you don't know how much each individual family gave. It's just kind of one group gift everybody.
Right.
That can be a nice workaround.
Housekeepers, 57% get a tip, or is it the is that what that 57% represents? 57% of people with housekeepers tip their housekeeper or gift their housekeeper at Christmas, right?
That's right, yeah. And then the median there was $50. So that was actually on the high end for both in terms of frequency and amount. One guideline for someone like a regular housekeeper or a regular babysitter or nanny, sometimes it's appropriate to give a tip equivalent to one service. So you might even go higher than that median of $50. You know, if you're paying them $100 every time they come. You know, maybe a really nice holiday gift is to basically double that. You don't have to do that, but that's a guideline. You might consider that even for someone who you do tip throughout the year, like a barber or a hairstylist. You know, normally maybe you tip 15 or 20%, but around the holidays, maybe you tip up to the full cost of a service. It's a rule of thumb. You know, I would say it's most appropriate if it's someone that you really have a relationship with and they really do a great job. Mm-hmm. And maybe they even go out of their way that, you know, they look the other way if you're late, or they stay open for you, or, you know, they do an especially good job. Those are the kind of people that should go to the top of the holiday tip list.
Well, and if you can afford it, like you said, it's probably good business for you, the customer. If that's your child care provider, 55% of people who have child care tip or gift their child care provider, but just 55%. I'm not going to say that they will treat your kid badly if you don't, but I think they will think more kindly about you, just, you know, subconsciously, and your kid. If you do tip a child care provider, 55% do, 53% of us tip teachers. Somebody texted in and said, who tips teachers? Give a gift to the teacher the way you described. Landscapers, 41, mail carriers, 31, trash and recycling people, 26. You know, another complication with this is, says 847, if you're not sure if today's mail carrier is the one you normally get, then maybe the one you normally have gets screwed. That can be a complication too, right?
It could be. The Postal Service is especially complicated because they technically discourage cash tips. They say that their employees can accept gifts, like physical items worth no more than $20. They seem okay with store-specific gift cards. They don't seem to like the general purpose Visa and MasterCard ones, but a store-specific gift card could be okay. But yeah, this does bring up the point about regular service providers versus maybe a fill-in. This might be more appropriate if you're accustomed to seeing them, you know, if you work from home, if you see the mail carrier, if you see the trash and recycling guys. I know that can be an awkward one too, because, you know, maybe they come in the wee hours of the morning and you don't really see them. Are you going to tape an envelope to the underside of the trash lid?
Yeah.
Is it going to blow away? Is it going to get thrown out? You could actually consider mailing something to the public works office and maybe directing it to the right person's attention. But I know it is tricky if you don't know their name or how to track them down. These are all some of the reasons why tipping is awkward and why some people don't do it.
I guess my takeaway, too, to the extent I do it, is that if it doesn't get to the exact person, somebody got the money, I felt good giving it away, and I hope that the right person gets it. But if it's the once every 2 weeks garbage guy that was filling in that day, he's having a merrier Christmas, you know, as a result. So I try not to keep too tight a score on how that works on the giving end. It's interesting thinking, and the numbers are all there at bankrate.com. Okay. Nice to talk to you as always, Ted Rossman. Thanks for your insights.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
Likewise. 1227 on WGN. John, death taxes and tips are now the guarantees of life. Don't forget dog groomers, says 847. Hey, how much do I tip an awesome personal trainer who I pay $80 a session to and I see twice a week? That's up to you and your God, 773. We used to call it a Christmas bonus. Garbage man and mail delivery, $40. What is a good gift amount for the security guard at the office? I think that's interesting. The people that man our lobby have what I think is a very thankless, anonymous job, but we see them every day. They're super pleasant. And I have thought about, it's the same thing. Now, putting a little gift card or something in an envelope and handing it to them. But the one I see tomorrow when I'm doing that might not be the one that's normally there. And I don't know if I should get 20 of them for everybody. So this is, you torture yourself and end up doing nothing. Hey, John Williams, I tip my UPS guy $100 every year. He knows my garage door code and places my orders inside. I live in Door County, Wisconsin, so most everything is ordered online. Deliveries 3 to 4 days a week. That seems like a smart investment of $100. And I don't even want to say investment. The idea is it's a gift. Hey, I like you. You're a nice person. You help me out in my life. You do a good job. Here's $100. John, my husband worked as a mail carrier for years. They get a lot of cash. Wow, I didn't know that. We also had a counter full of baked goods. Hey, John, don't forget pet sitters. We're the ones that allow people to leave their animals at home to go on vacation or out for a night or to work or to take care of. So to take care of their animals, make sure their home is taken care of, too. Leave a tip for your pet sitters. Leave a tip for everybody. And for broadcasters, patronize our sponsors, I say. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. Hello there. Do you get tips?
I get the other kind of tips. I get the tips that turn into stories, but nobody ever offers me cash.
Yeah, that's it. Somebody calls and goes, I got a tip, and you go, yeah, I'd rather have 50 bucks.
Well, yeah, at the holiday season, yes, but generally I'm very thankful for the tips that come in about real estate sales.
What would that be like for you?
Oh, you mean like a celebrity has sold and it's, you know, off the record, that sort of thing. Are you asking me what kind of tips I get? Yeah, celebrity's house is going on the market.
Dennis Rodkin is the residential real estate reporter at Crane's Chicago Business. Speaking of celebrities, the biggest residential property taxpayer of the year is?
J.B. Pritzker and M.K. Pritzker, his wife.
Oh, two separate tax bills?
Well, their household. Yeah. But it is two separate tax bills because what we're talking about here is what they, you know, they just bought these condos for $19 million from Ken Griffin. They also have a mansion on Astor Street, which they bought for $14 million and renovated to the tune of another $25 million. And these are the tax bills. What I did is add up what they will be paying when they're responsible for the tax bill on Walton Street, because as you know, in Cook County in particular, you're always billed for the year before. So even though they've taken possession, Ken Griffin will still be responsible for the bill. But when the bills are going to the Pritzkers, they will be paying at least $1.29 million in property taxes a year.
Hmm. Is he going to hire one of those city council members who has a tax abatement business?
Well, you know, I think this is probably, it's $1.29 million sounds like a lot to you and to me. But don't forget that J.B. Pritzker is worth over $4 billion. As I said in the story, this property tax bill may seem like pennies.
Yeah. Well, and even if it was onerous to him, I would look bad for the governor to try and dodge some of his tax obligations.
Yeah, we already know. Remember what flared up for him when on Astor Street they bought the house next door, removed the toilets. Many people believe that was done in order to drop the property tax bill. That was done before he was in politics, but then when he gets into politics, it really becomes a problem for him. So
yeah, right.
I think, and now, of course, he has a very different profile as governor, and I think would be far less likely to do so. Although, to be clear, he can't remove the toilets here. These are unfinished condos they bought from Ken Griffin.
Unfinished?
This is empty space that they will have to finish. And so the property tax bill will go up when those properties are finished.
If a property is deemed uninhabitable, then the property tax is less, right?
Right.
And a property without toilets accomplishes that.
Exactly.
But then the place Ken Griffin sold him, which is funny because they're politically opposite.
I know, that was a great headline.
One guy
wants
to do business with the other. But I guess if it's a house, it's a house, right? And or an apartment, it's an apartment. You want that physical structure. You have to divorce yourself of who you're giving the money to.
I think so. You know, I was sort of waiting for Ken Griffin to show up. He talks to a lot of the financial press, and then they ask him the personal questions. He wouldn't talk to me or to the Tribune, which first reported the sale of the condos. He won't talk to us about a condo sale. But I was hoping that in one of his appearances in the financial press, they would say, hey, we understand you've just sold some condos to somebody who is essentially your political nemesis, somebody for whom you funded an opponent. And I was hoping he would say something about that, but he hasn't yet. It's
Ken
been
Griffin.
A month since he bought them, yeah. And Griffin hasn't said. I would imagine that someday he says something like, all right, I stuck Pritzker with the tax bill, or whatever he would say.
Oh, right, sure.
Obviously,
sure.
I can't speak for Ken Griffin.
Well, so Walton and Astor Street, these are Gold Coast condos or homes or apartments or whatever?
The mansion on Astor Street is something they bought in 2007. It's spectacular. It's beautiful. And again, they paid $14
million. You're talking about J.B. Pritzker.
J.B. and M.K. Pritzker. I was covering at the time their move down from Evanston, not because at the time I had to spell out who these people were. They made this gigantic purchase, this $14 million purchase in 2007, sold a house in Evanston. And then eventually they bought the house next door to the one on Astor Street, which is the one with the toilet question. And then the ones on Walton Street, yeah, they're the, what is it, the 37th and 38th floors. Ken Griffin had owned four floors, 35 through 38. And he also, the 38th floor has a pool on top. The only finished part of that four-story stack is the pool on top of it. And what the Pritzkers bought is the top two floors, which would include that pool.
So when you say unfinished, do they have to, it's not down to the studs, right?
It is, yeah.
Oh, really?
It's empty. It is unfinished space. It's basically a box.
They've got to put a drywall and
there's nothing,
floor
yeah.
plan.
The photos we have run with the story are, you know, you see windows and you see scraped clean floors and steel joists.
And that was $19 million?
$19 million for two floors.
But it must be a great view.
Oh, it's an amazing view. First of all, well, when you go up to your pool level, you're looking down on somebody else's pool several stories below, but you're also looking out over the entire city. And these two floors are, well, they're full floors,
wrap
so you're
around.
Looking in four
you
directions.
360. So where do the Pritzkers live then?
Well, I would assume...
Do they reside in this place on Astor?
On Astor. I would assume they do when they're not in Springfield.
Yeah.
In a mansion that they don't own, that the public owns, but that they paid for some renovation of.
Yeah, I'm sure that place in Springfield is swell, but given my druthers...
Yeah.
I think I'd be over here in Chicago looking at the lake and the city lights.
Yeah, well, they're not quite looking at the lake. They're near it when they get to these condos. And we don't know, so... All that the governor's spokesperson would say when this transaction happened was, yes, the governor has bought a condo. That's it. So we don't know anything about, I mean, just as one example, is this what they're planning as a retirement space? Because, you know, it's all elevator.
Well, that makes it accessible
by elevator.
Yeah.
Is this because of greater security needed because you're governor? I have no idea. All of that is just the ideas people have given me. But it's also true that, you know, their kids are grown and they bought this mansion in 2007. Everybody eventually wants to move. Maybe they decided we'd rather live in a condo now.
Yeah, I get that. But boy, you'd want a yard. I've had dogs in a tall building and it's a lot of work too.
Well, don't forget, they have yards in Wisconsin and Florida and in the Bahamas. So when they want to go outside, they have some other properties. The Pritzkers do.
Okay, but then if my dog's got to pee, I got to go to O'Hare. I don't want to do that. Let's talk a little bit about some other real estate news. We'll do all of that in a minute. First, let's update you on some other business. Here is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago has a new Michelin star restaurant. It's Cariño at 4662 North Broadway in the Uptown neighborhood. The eatery features Mexican and Latin American inspired dishes prepared by Chef Norman Fenton. It opened in 2023. The Michelin stars were awarded Monday night in New York. Michelin says its inspectors were delighted by the bold and creative tasting menu, in addition to diligent and engaging service from staff. It says Fenton's creations celebrate Mexican cuisine in an ambitious manner. Cariño is a Spanish word that refers to a feeling of fondness or love that a person has for someone or something. Chicago has 19 Michelin-starred restaurants. Four eateries lost stars this year. Northwest Indiana will be the location of a new facility that converts organic waste from the Chicago area into renewable natural gas. Nexus W2V says funding has been secured for the facility in La Porte, and it should be operational by the end of 2026. Waste in various forms diverted from area landfills will be converted into biomethane at the plant. The company hopes to open additional facilities across the country. One estimate says renewable natural gas produced from waste could replace nearly 4.5% of current fossil fuel demand in the U.S. and 16.5% of core gas customer demand. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food. Now, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And let's dial in a radio broadcast from 83 years ago this past Saturday.
We have witnessed this morning a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes.
That bulletin from station KGU in Honolulu broke the news that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. Right away, the government called on American farmers to produce more food for the war effort. It wasn't easy. USDA historian Ann Eflin says not only were young men being drafted off the farm into the Army.
There were restrictions on use of rubber and steel, which affected use of farm machinery.
So non-farmers were called on to grow food. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at Chevy Drives Chicago. AmericanFarmers.com. While American farmers were feeding the troops and the Allies, non-farmers were called into action with Victory Gardens. But it was not a new effort.
That's right. The World War II Victory Garden movement really had its origins in World War I.
Rose Hayden Smith is an expert on World War II Victory Gardens. You could say she wrote the book on it, because she did.
Called Sowing the Seeds of Victory.
It turned out Americans loved gardening so much they never stopped, continuing through the Depression and into World War II.
There were a lot of people around who had been kids in World War I, and they had experienced the Liberty Victory Garden program in World War I.
Gardens all over the place.
There would be school gardens and home gardens and gardens in communities.
The Victory Gardeners were not feeding the troops directly, but
the more that people could produce and consume locally, the more resources you had to ship supplies and materiel. It was incredibly helpful.
In fact, it all worked so well, the president was able to tell the nation 2 years later,
"There is enough food today for all of us, and enough left over to send to those who are fighting with us."
And that, many believe, helped win the war for the Allies. Today, those same types of community gardens on vacant lots all over the place are helping in the war on obesity. The USDA is sponsoring People's Gardens in Chicago and many other cities to try to get us to eat healthier. On the food calendar, it's National Lager Day. Think beer, not Paul Bunyan. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We got a couple more minutes with Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Chicago area homes under contract in November did what?
Skyrocketed.
Really?
27% over the year before, that was in November, over November 2023 and also November 2022. Those 2 months were flat with one another. We're seeing enormous numbers of homes go under contract. Not everything that goes under contract does eventually sell. Most do. And so what we're expecting is December, January, we're going to see big increases in the number of sales. Part of it is, it appears people have finally said, you know, interest rates aren't going to go down. They're going to stay here in the 6.5-7% range for a while. I'm done waiting. I have various reasons to move. We have a baby on the way. Whatever it is, we got to move. Let's just go ahead at this interest rate, as well as the fact that, especially in Chicago, our home prices are rising so fast. Our prices have been rising at twice the pace of the nation's prices for several months now. So if you're a buyer, you're thinking, yeah, you know, even if interest rates go down, it's not going to mitigate the increase in price. So I got to get it now.
Right.
And so we've seen in November, we saw a 27% increase in the number of homes going under contract.
In what's the jurisdiction on that?
That's the 9-county area. That's
really,
the metro
Chicago
area. It's covered by Midwest real estate.
One area hotter than another, would you say?
Well, you know, the outer parts of the city, the parts of the city that are not downtown, are doing really well. The close-in suburbs, you know, during COVID, we were talking a lot about the Barringtons and the Lake Forests, which were booming because you didn't have to go into the office as much anymore. Now that a lot of that has reversed, we're seeing a lot more buying in the close-in suburbs and within the city.
What's a close-in suburb then?
Oak Park, Evanston,
right,
Morton
yeah.
Grove, Park Ridge.
Sure. Speaking of that, hey, please ask Dennis this. Will Google be bringing more people into Chicago when the old Thompson Center is complete? I'm hoping it will boost the value of my condo in Lakeshore East, and some young people will jump at the opportunity to have forever views from Randolph Street to the south.
You know, one thing I don't know is whether Google, of course, has its big facility in the West Loop. I don't know whether moving to the Thompson Center, the former Thompson Center, brings an increase of jobs. I don't know whether that's been reported, and it's not something I've covered. So I certainly can't say that's going to happen. But I do think, I mean, there's a lot going on that makes this neighborhood we're sitting in, Lakeshore East, very appealing. If you're buying a condo because you work at Google in the Thompson Center, or any other reason, you work downtown, this is a great area for it, because there's dining right at the core and a park right at the core. And then there's the larger park just south.
Millennium Park, just south. Grand Park.
This neighborhood does quite well. I can't speak to what would happen when Google comes in, just because, as I said, I don't know whether that's more employees. If all those people who work in the West Loop already have you know, their homes nailed down and they're really only going to commute a little bit more to get to the Thompson Center?
We're at 303 East Wacker. You and I are sitting 18 stories up, one block, say, east of Michigan Avenue along the Chicago River. We are flush with the Chicago River. We're two doors down from the Jeannie Gang St. Regis curvy skyscraper. But in general, I got 45 seconds. What would you say about condo living in the city? Has that become more attractive?
You know, John, we are still, I'm almost a broken record on this. We are still seeing condos downtown selling at their early 2000s prices. We're seeing a lot less demand for downtown condos. You just mentioned St. Regis. Just last month, the developers of St. Regis sold 84 condos in bulk, unsold condos in bulk to an investor, the investor that also owns a piece of the hotel. A colleague and I are looking into the implications of that, but you know, when that building was announced in 2014, there was an expectation it would fill up fast. It's Jeannie Gang. It's right on the river. Super high floors where you'd have views forever.
Two new restaurants.
Two new restaurants. But at this point, there are at least 84 of the 320 condos still unsold. And sales started. Sales started in 2016 and move-ins started in 2019.
It's like a developer just buying a chunk of real estate and then hoping to develop it themselves, right?
We don't yet know what the investor buyer is going to do with those 84 condos. Again, they also are an investor in the restaurants, the hotel downstairs. We do know some of the condos that were sold in bulk have come back on the market because one of the questions is, did they buy those 84 to rent them? And they won't talk. They may by the time we've finished the
story. I'll tell you what they should do with those.
What should they do with them?
Pickleball courts. Dennis Rodkin, the highest, most expensive pickleball in America. Residential real estate reporter at Cranes. You can quote me on that. Thank you, Dennis.
I will.
Yeah, I bet he won't.